It's James chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water.
Now we go over a page or two to James chapter 5, verse 13.
Is any one of you in trouble? He should pray. Is anyone happy? Let him sing songs of praise. Is anyone sick? He should call the elders of the church to pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer offered in faith will make the sick person well. The Lord will raise him up. If he has sinned, he will be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to each other, so that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective. Elijah was a man, just like us. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3.5 years. Again he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crops. My brothers, if one of you should wander from the truth, and someone should bring him back, remember this. Whoever turns a sinner from the error of his way will save him from death and cover over a multitude of sins.
In 1958, a man called Robert Parkins offered himself for the Anglican priesthood. He was turned down on the rather surprising grounds that he appeared not to have any Christian faith. Never usually wise the Church of England, but it did in this case. Had these electors looked a bit further, they would have found two other reasons for not ordaining him. One is that Mrs. Parkins, whom he presented, was in fact the fourth Mrs. Parkins. It had three previous ones and had married the extra one without divorcing the earlier one. So he was a serial bigamist. He was to go on to have three more wives, so he was a very serial bigamist. The other problem was his academic qualifications. He claimed to have a degree in history from Oxford University. In fact, the sum of his qualifications was 3 O-levels. However, being turned down for the Anglican priesthood didn't put him off. He went to the clerical outfitters Whipple's in central London, bought himself a set of dog collars and a cassock and a surplice, the white thing, and set off for South Africa. And there he managed to persuade the church in Durban, or near Durban, to appoint him vicar. And while he was there, he got people to take snaps of him doing priestly things like conducting weddings and funerals, Holy Communion, meeting children and so on, all in his clerical gear. So after a few years, he returned to England and went to the Bishop of Oxford, whom he correctly took to be a somewhat credulous sort of chap, and persuaded the bishop to appoint him to be vicar of a parish in the northern part of the county. So there he was, vicar of this village in Oxfordshire. So he had a house, an income, a stipend, and status. But that wasn't enough for Robert Parkins. He wanted more money. So what he did is he founded a thing called the Cambridge Institute for Religious Studies. And this purported to be affiliated to Cambridge University with the authority to award doctoral degrees. You can become a doctor, whatnot. But in fact, all it was a P.O. box number. And you sent a sort of 5,000-word essay on some religious topic. He notionally marked it, never bothered to look at it, but just gave it a mark, and awarded you a PhD, a nice big embossed certificate. And you, of course, had to pay him quite a hefty sum for this. But even that wasn't enough. He decided what he really wanted was to be a professor. So what he did was this. Rather ingenious, this, actually. He got himself a job as a part-time reader for Oxford University Press, and it meant in history, and he read doctoral theses to see if they were fit for publication. And what he did is, having read a thesis, he would distill it into an article size length and submit it to a learned journal for publication. And by this method, he had several articles published in learned historical journals in his name, but having stolen the research from PhD students. And on the basis of this, he applied for a job as a professor of history in university in Toronto and got the job. Wow. Well, that was his undoing. But unfortunately, a junior lecturer in history in the same department decided, out of curiosity, he would look up Robert Parkins' articles in these learned journals. And as he did so, he thought, oh, this particular article is rather similar to my research. And he went off to see the professor, Professor Parkins, to ask about this. And gradually one question led to another, and so the whole fraud was ultimately exposed. And Robert Parkins was extradited back to Britain, where he stood trial and served several years at Her Majesty's pleasure in Wormwood Scrubs. An amazing story. Now, to do that sort of fraud, you have to have a special bravado, I think. But there's another sort of dishonesty I was reading about recently that is on the rise very considerably in supermarkets, and it's shoplifting. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with those self-service cashier things. I take my two smallest grandchildren from my Tesco shop every week, and they love it, putting things beep beep, and then messages from the bagging area, a bagging alert, all that kind of thing. It's fabulous. You keep having to jab the screen. So I'm quite familiar with these self-service cash machines. But what you do, I'm not recommending this, by the way, for easy form of shoplifting. Let's say you have some loose carrots and you fancy some smoked salmon. So you put the loose carrots on the thing that weighs them, and you slip the smoked salmon underneath. And so you're, as it were, charging weight by weight for smoked salmon what a carrot would be. So it's a form of shoplifting. Now, the supermarkets are well aware of all that, but it's worth it for them because they save a lot of money on having fewer cashiers, and that more than compensates for the loss of the shoplifting. Now, I suspect nobody in this church this morning is capable of shoplifting. Let's imagine you had a slightly sort of odd moment and you thought, I think I'll go into a bit of shoplifting from Morrison's down the road. And you did what I've just, or began to do what I've just suggested, carrots on the weighing machine, then you got your smoked salmon, and your hand would freeze at that moment. You just wouldn't be able to slip it under the carrots. You would freeze. As for imagining the sort of fraud that Robert Parkins perpetrated, I'm quite sure even just thinking of doing it yourself, you'd have a nervous breakdown. We are not capable of that level of dishonesty. So what's the difference between us and the many people who shoplift regularly from the supermarkets? Why are we different from them? Well, one obvious answer is that we have active consciences that prevent us doing really bad things, and they don't. An obvious answer. Now, everything that we experience spiritually has a physical counterpart. That's actually what the Bible teaches, if you kind of unpack it. And the physical counterpart to our conscience, that experience, that spiritual experience of conscience, is something called the amygdala, which is a little bit of the brain, somewhere in there, which, when you are about to do something really bad, goes beep, beep, beep. It registers, sends out electrical impulses round the brain that make you feel really frightened and worried and not wanting to do it. That's how, as it were, conscience physically works. It's still a spiritual experience, but that's the physical counterpart. But there's a very interesting thing that neuroscientists have recently discovered about the amygdala, as you can sort of spot it with these sort of imaging machines, is that the more you override it, the weaker it becomes. So the first time you go shoplifting, gosh, it's really hard to do it. But if you manage to override it, then the next time you go shoplifting, it's a little bit weaker. And the next time, weaker still. Until eventually, shoplifting doesn't strike you as wrong at all. It's just one of those things that you do. Wow. Now that has rather frightening implications for all of us. Now, okay, our amygdalas are quite active when it comes to straightforward stealing, dishonesty and fraud. But there may be other sins of which you are guilty, but they're so habitual that we don't register them as sins anymore, we just commit them. Let me give one or two examples. Well, James, that passage that Jenny gave us on the tongue. How many of us are sometimes cruel in what we say? How many of us might be habitually cruel? I this is a big confession. I used to be quite sarcastic. I think it was before I became involved, or maybe this church changed me. I'm not sarcastic now, but I could be really quite nasty in the things I said. But it was so habitual that I did it without thinking about it. And that's me. Let's say you're an angry or impatient person. You're so habitually angry and impatient that it doesn't register as anything wrong. Let's say you're rather lazy about doing good. When somebody's in need, you always find some reason why it's not you that should do anything about them. It might be that you harbour resentments, grudges against people. And it's so habitual, you no longer regard those grudges as evil in any way. It's just the way things are. Now, I suggest that all of us, because we are sinners, remember, all of us have sins within us that are like that. They become habitual. And so we no longer register them as sins. So what do we do? The first thing, and this is, I think, what the second reading from James partly tells us, is we should be willing to interrogate ourselves. We are sinners. We're not perfect, we're sinners. And we should be willing to interrogate ourselves to wonder, in what particular ways am I a sinner? In what particular ways have I kind of numbed my amygdala, my conscience? Now, when you begin to do that, start to interrogate yourself, it's really very uncomfortable, as I'm sure you know. I mean, when I think back at cruel things I've said in the past, I just want the sort of whole earth to swallow me up. I feel so ashamed. And that's the experience all of us have when we actually acknowledge a real sinful inclination within us. We feel utterly wretched and ashamed. The amygdala, as it were, is reactivated at that moment. But then something rather wonderful and extraordinary happens. You realise that the sins are not just against other people who may never forgive you, they're against God. That all the while you've been offending God by that particular sin. Every cruel word I ever uttered was an offence to God. I didn't think of it like that at the time, but it was. And once you recognise the sin, then you discover that God has already forgiven you. He's stretched out his hands to you already, offering to redeem you, to buy you back. He's taken upon himself the entire consequence of your sin. That's what happened on the cross. Even to death itself, he takes upon himself. So you can lay the burden of that sin at the foot of the cross, Bunyan style, and he will take it upon himself. So that's the wonderful miracle of the redemption as we experience it. Is actually knowing at that moment that God has already forgiven us. and then the process of sanctification, of becoming holy as Christ alone is holy, then that can begin. But that brings us to one particular sin, which is very, very hard to recognise, but the worst sin of all. You won't have thought of it. Possibly you will. But that brings us back to Robert Parkins. Now, when he finally came to trial, sometime in the 1960s, it, of course, had huge publicity in the press. The News of the World, the People, all that kind of thing, were full of it. And he was known as the Romeo Rev, after the seven wives he'd had. sort of Henry VIII plus one, as it were. So, as I say, huge publicity. At the end of it, he was sentenced to prison, as I said earlier. And the Bishop of Oxford, who had given him the parish, got up and said, "I now commit myself to converting Robert Parkins to the Christian faith. That's what I'm going to do. And to that end, I will visit him every month, in prison." That's what he committed himself to do, made a great song and dance about it. And that's what he went on to do. And he used to write about it in the Diocesan magazine each month, how he'd been getting on with Robert Parkins. Well, Robert Parkins finally finished his prison sentence and was released, and the bishop declared that Robert Parkins was now a fully converted Christian. And to show his faith in Robert Parkins, he appointed him to be his personal secretary. Well, that meant that Robert Parkins had access to the so-called blue files. Every Anglican priest is frightened of his blue file. It's the file that bishops keep on you about you, and if you've committed any misdemeanours, boing, in they go. So Robert Parkins had access to all these sort of stories of sexual misdemeanours committed by the clergy of Oxford Diocese. Wonderful opportunity for blackmail. So he would go to the clergy and say, if you don't give me a hefty sum, I'll expose you. So he did this successively, made more and more money. It was actually a scam that was bound to fail in the end. One day he would meet up with a clergyman who, like the Duke of Wellington, faced with a similar situation, said, "Publish and be damned." And that's what this particular clergyman did, and then went to the police. Robert Parkins was arrested, back in prison. Now, the bishop was devastated. He was devastated for three reasons. One, he was devastated because of Robert Parkins not being a Christian. The second, he was devastated about his clergy who had been blackmailed. But third, he was personally devastated because he realised that his motives had not been pure. He was rather proud of his own virtue and holiness and sanctity, and was convinced that these qualities would win over Robert Parkins to the faith. And he rather enjoyed reporting on how all this wonderful thing was going on in the Diocesan magazine. In other words, he was guilty of that the hardest of sins, spiritual pride. And why it's so hard is it takes advantage of the good. As we make our sort of faltering steps with God's grace to become a little bit better than we were, as we begin the process of becoming sanctified and holy, then this cancer arrives. We begin to take pride. I take pride in my own holiness and sanctity. And as soon as that cancer gets in, it eats away at the virtue itself. Because after all, to be virtuous out of pride is not to be virtuous at all. So it's a terrible cancer. And to acknowledge it as to acknowledge the possibility that all those steps you've made in the Christian faith can be undermined. It's a really hard thing to recognise. But the bishop did. He recognised that his motives had been mixed and he had been guilty of the sin of spiritual pride. That's the end of the story. But there's a little sort of slight sequel to it. We don't know. Robert Parkins disappeared into obscurity. The only thing we know about him is that he died in Kettering General Hospital in Northamptonshire in the year 2005. We don't know anything about the state of his soul at that moment. The bishop, having realised he was just an ordinary sinner like the rest of us, even though he was a bishop, he was just an ordinary sinner like the rest of us, he accepted that. And over the years, he acquired a reputation for great holiness. And that's the challenge for all of us. only when we genuinely are willing to acknowledge our sins before God and accept ourselves as just ordinary common or garden sinners. Only then can the process of God's grace making us holy actually begin.